Welcome to Now. I'm David Byrd.
And I'm Aisha Khalid.
There's a new virus that has made its way from the Middle East to the Midwestern U.S. We'll have a look at MERS.
The total health security of the globe is really tied up in identifying these threats as quickly as possible and then trying to stop them in their tracks.
We'll talk about the so-called pollen vortex that has people sneezing.
There's really no scientific way of predicting how bad a season is going to be until it happens.
Is your office environment making you old?
What injuries do runners face when they start to exercise?
There's a new breath test for lung cancer.
And there's a new documentary that looks at why more than one-third of Americans are obese.
That's all coming up on this Wednesday edition of Now. Recently, a man in the Midwestern U.S. state of Indiana was diagnosed with a dangerous new respiratory infection, MERS.
MERS had previously been found only in the Middle East, but now appears to have spread, and experts fear it could become a global menace.
VOA's Steve Barragona has been looking into this story and found out that lessons learned from another deadly condition, SARS, could help scientists fight this new disease.
First, the bad news from epidemiologist David Swerdlow. He heads the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's response to Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, or MERS.
30 to 40% of people who get it have died. It's caused illness in multiple countries. The virus clearly spreads from person to person, and it's severe, and there's no treatment or vaccine. So we are concerned.
The MERS virus first appeared in September of 2012. Saudi Arabia has seen the most cases. It's a member of the coronavirus family, which includes germs that cause the common cold, as well as severe acute respiratory syndrome, or SARS. That disease popped up in southern China in 2003, infected about 8,000 people in 29 countries, and killed about 800 before it was contained. Here's a bit of good news. MERS does not spread as well as SARS did, according to Amish Adalja with the Infectious Diseases Society of America. He spoke to VOA by Skype.
With SARS, we saw much more human transmissibility, and we also saw individuals who we called super spreaders, people who disproportionately spread the virus more than anybody else and were really responsible for how the virus made its way all around the world.
There are no MERS super spreaders, Adalja says, at least not yet. The most recent data from the World Health Organization reports 261 MERS infections, including 93 deaths. Other case tallies are higher and put the death toll over 100. A spike in cases in Saudi Arabia beginning last week has raised worries among health experts that the virus has mutated into a more spreadable form. That would be a danger sign, but the CDC's David Swerdlow says German researchers have examined DNA from some of the new Saudi cases.
The information that they've shown suggests that there has not than any significant change in the virus.
That's good news, but Swerdlow says researchers need more data to be sure. And he adds they still do not know why the case count spiked.
Some of this could be seasonality. Some of it could be better surveillance. Some of it could be just that there's a large outbreak ongoing in some healthcare facilities, perhaps.
Many of the victims have been healthcare workers who come in close contact with sick patients. And many of the sickest patients have had other health problems, such as kidney disease, cancer, or diabetes. It's not yet clear where MERS came from originally, but camels are the lead suspect. Unfortunately, there's a lot about MERS that scientists do not know. What they do know, says IDSA's Amish Adalja, are lessons that SARS drove home.
The world is a small place, that borders don't mean anything, and that the total health security of the globe is really tied up in identifying these threats as quickly as possible and then trying to stop them in their tracks.
That's why health officials around the world are keeping a close eye on MERS. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
So what do you think? Let us know your thoughts by addressing an email to voaasia@voanews.com.
Or you can log on to our Facebook page. That's VOA Asia.
And we are on Twitter. Our address there is @NowVOAShow.
Aisha, do you have allergies? Does pollen in the trees bother you?
David, pollen allergies? Mm. No, but I'm allergic to certain foods like shell seafood.
Oh, okay.
Yes, shrimp and some tree nuts also. But pollen allergies, no. But my 5 years old, he has pollen allergies, and I've learned a lot about pollen allergy patients' management, you know, through doctor's visits for him.
Wow, that's something, you know.
I'd like to add one thing here.
Yes.
Islamabad, the capital of Pakistan,
yes,
and the city of my birth, there the pollen allergy issue is big. And in some people, the pollen allergies problem is so bad that doctors advise those people to move out of the city if it's possible for them.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah. I wondered if this year was any worse than other years because, you know, there was talk that there was going to be what they call a pollen vortex with more pollen in the air than in previous years.
You know, David, I saw some TV reports about how this time the pollen season was going to be really bad.
Mm.
Some people believe that because of the long, cold winter the United States just came through, that pollens would be heavier than previous years.
Yeah, but Dr. David Golden is the chief of allergy at Sinai Hospital, just up the road from our headquarters in Baltimore. He told the Associated Press there's no real way to predict how bad the pollen can be.
There's really no scientific way of predicting how bad a season is going to be until it happens.
Dr. Golden's office is one of 79 National Allergy Bureau certified pollen counting stations across the country. Golden says early talk of a pollen vortex hasn't panned out.
What they're saying about the polar vortex and the very cold winter that we had this year is that things would come in late and everything would happen at once, so it would be particularly bad. That's actually not what happened.
Dr. Golden agrees it will be a tough allergy season for those of us who suffer, but that this year is not as bad as some others.
Well, they're right in the sense that it's going to be bad. It's bad every year. There are years that are worse, and that has more to do with the weather during the peak season or at any time.
Golden's office keeps a count on the density of pollen in the air using special sampling machinery. Anytime there are more than 90 pollen grains in a cubic meter of air, it is considered high.
For people who suffer from sneezing, itchy eyes, congestion, or other ailments, the end of the pollen season can't come soon enough.
Lauren Berger of Atlanta, Georgia, is one of those people.
Definitely ready to see the start of summer so that we can get rid of all this pollen. It's just gross and makes it hard to be outside for long periods of time.
But I'm sure you take all the precautions, right?
Well, I mean, I make sure that I wash my clothes and my sheets and, you know,
before going to bed.
Yep.
Your hair.
Well, I actually wash my hair in the morning so it won't look funky. But, you know, I know that you're supposed to shower before you go to bed. If you have pollen. Yeah, and, you know, we've got to wash the dog because we have two dogs, and they love being outside. But the pollen.
Do they have long hair?
No, they don't have long hair, but, you know, they're dogs. And,
of course,
they're out in the grass, rompy, rompy, rompy. And, you know, the pollen comes from the trees and gets on the grass,
gets on the dog. And it gets worse at night, right?
Yes. It does.
Yeah.
My car is now a lovely shade of yellow.
I remember when the pediatrician, tested my son positive.
Mm.
I was like, no, as if it was the end of the world for him. But then I came to terms with it. I was like, okay.
Now, what does he have to do? What does your
son?
Does he have to take shots or pills or?
No. So far, he's just on Claritin and Zyrtec and inhaler.
Okay.
When did you start having the allergies?
When I moved to Northern Virginia.
Oh, okay. Not as a child then.
No. The ironic thing is, as a child, I lived in North Carolina and we had pine trees.
Yeah.
And the pine pollen would literally come off in giant yellow clouds, tore my mother up. She was like I am now. But, we didn't have that many hardwoods. Mm-hmm. And so things like oak or maple or, you know, tulip poplar or any of those things that we have around here in Washington, we didn't have them. And so I never developed an immunity or an allergy to them because they weren't there.
Mm-hmm.
Pine pollen didn't bother me at all. I could play in it.
I was born and raised in Islamabad.
Right.
I spent more than 30 years of my life over there.
Right.
I was I did not see a lot of people suffering from pollen allergies.
Mm.
But then, like in my later years of my life in Islamabad, then I started seeing people, more and more people, you know, suffering from allergies.
Huh.
So I don't know.
So what about you? Do seasonal allergies make warm weather miserable for you?
Let us know by sending an email to voaasia@voanews.com.
Or you can post a comment on our Facebook page. Our address there is VOA Asia. Aisha and I both work in an office building here at VOA, and many of you might do the same. But did you know that working in an office can make you old prematurely?
Recent research shows that the typical office environment is aging people quicker than previously thought.
So what is it about office work that ages people? Well, one thing is sitting all day.
A Northwestern University study found that people who sit too much are more likely to be disabled and shorten their life expectancy.
Now, what are you supposed to do about that? Simple. Get up. Stand up when you make a phone call or maybe when you go to a meeting with your supervisor. Or maybe another thing you can do is just get up and walk around your office for a few paces.
And another thing to do is park farther away from your office and walk before you get to work.
And, you know, if you work at a computer, that, too, can make you old prematurely.
Slouching at your workstation is bad for your back and neck and can even cause pain.
And staring at a computer monitor can damage your eyes and keep you from sleeping properly.
Also, staring at paperwork can cause eye strain. Take a break. Close your eyes and give them a few minutes rest.
And a stressful environment can make you age prematurely as well. Researchers in a 2012 study found that stress can affect portions of our DNA called telomeres, which have been linked to how long you live.
And talking of stress, it can also raise your risk of stroke or heart attack and can increase blood pressure.
And the lights in your office? Well, they can make you look older. Fluorescent lights and overexposure to them can lead to stress, fatigue, high blood pressure, and even inability to sleep.
People should avoid these lights at close range if possible.
You know, there was a time when I was in Japan, and they had this water device in this office building. Mm-hmm. And it was basically a series of stones arranged in kind of a cascading thing, and the water would fall over them like a waterfall. And it made that lovely shh kind of thing, you know, and you went down this hallway and all you could hear around you was water. Mm-hmm. And I get down to the bottom of this hallway and there's these three Japanese guys completely lost to the world. They're like taking a power nap. All three of them, you know, business suits, briefcase, and they're just like, gone. Absolutely gone. But I think that that kind of thing.
I envy such people, you know, who can sleep like that.
Well, I think that that kind of thing is not a bad thing, though.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, every now and then it'd be nice to go, you know, to a room with, like, plants and, you know, soft water sounds or something, and just kind of like, oh. So what about you? Do you work in an office? Do you think your office is making you old prematurely?
Let us know your thoughts by sending an email to voaasia@voanews.com.
Or log on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
And we are on Twitter. Our address there is at Now VOA Show.
Tomorrow way too far away. And we can't get back yesterday, but we young right now, we got right now, so get up right now, 'cause all we got is right now.
The recent Boston Marathon might have inspired some of you to go out and take a run to try to get in shape. In the Northern Hemisphere, summer is coming anyway, and exercise is good to lengthen your life, but is that little twinge you feel when you go for your morning jog just an irritating injury? Is it something more serious? Or is it just part of exercising after sitting through a long winter? Well, to find out, we're on the line with Dr. Derek Ochiai. He is a board-certified orthopedic surgeon and sports medicine expert. He's talking to us from Arlington, Virginia. Dr. Ochiai, first of all, thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me, David.
Let's run down some of the more common, not necessarily injuries, but for lack of a better way of putting it, irritations that runners might run into. One of the first things I want to ask about, it's a condition known as runner's knee. What exactly is runner's knee, and how can you tell if you have it?
Okay, well, I mean, runner's knee kind of goes through, it could encompass a couple of different things. I mean, one is really a tightness of your iliotibial band. So you feel it more on the side of your knee, and you know it'll be tender to touch, like right over the bone on the outside of your knee. It's related to having a really tight iliotibial band, which is pretty common in a distance runners. Another could be in the front of your knee. If it's like when you sit down, if it's directly in front of your knee is where you're feeling the tenderness, that would be patellar tendonitis, inflammation of the tendon that attaches your kneecap to your shin bone. It'll be tender to touch. You know, you may have some pain when you try to forcefully extend your knee or straighten it out.
Now, what about something on the back of your leg, like in the hamstring muscles? Are there issues there, too, that people should be aware of?
Oh, absolutely. The distance runners have a tendency to be rather on the less flexible side. A lot of times, distance runners can have tightness of their hamstring tendons, and their hamstrings go down in the back and then wrap around the front of the knee. You can definitely have some irritation there. In addition, you may get some swelling in the back of your knee that comes and goes intermittently. That's called a Baker's cyst, and that's some joint fluid that's leaking out the back of your knee and causing intermittent swelling there.
Now, how can somebody know when it's just an irritation and when it's time to come visit someone like you or maybe a physical therapist? What are some signs of a more serious injury that a runner would need to go see a physician?
If it's something that's stopping you from running, if you're trying to run and you start feeling a sharp pain and it's making you limp, those are signs that you should probably see someone who can evaluate you for possible stress fractures and things like that, which can happen when you have a rapid change in activity level.
All right, that is Dr. Derek Ochiai. He is a board-certified orthopedic surgeon and sports medicine expert, and he spoke to us from Arlington, Virginia.
When most of us think of a breath test, it usually involves a policeman trying to see if you've been drinking.
But there's another kind of breath test that could help save your life from cancer.
VOA's Jessica Berman tells us the test helps doctors determine when a patient's trouble is something benign or something deadly.
When an X-ray scan of a patient's lungs reveals a nodule or tiny mass, the challenge for doctors is determining whether the growth is benign or a sign of early-stage cancer. Investigators say the breath analysis could help when used in conjunction with PET scans or other imaging modalities. Researchers conducted a trial involving 107 patients with lung cancer, 40 people with benign lung nodules, and 7 individuals whose cancer had spread to other parts of the body. The results were compared to a group of 88 healthy individuals. The breath analysis was almost as sensitive as high-tech imaging at identifying patients with lung cancer, and it was twice as accurate at distinguishing benign lung disease, dramatically reducing the rate of so-called false positives. Michael Busrama is an associate professor at the University of Louisville Medical School and the study's lead author. He says lung spots are often detected on X-ray or CT scan when a patient goes to the doctor complaining of shortness of breath or chest pain.
In this day and age, what you do is you do a biopsy. Either you stick a needle into it through the skin and into the lung, into the mass, or you do a bronchoscopy, or you might get a PET scan to determine whether or not it's more or less likely to be cancer. All of those things are expensive, and the CT-guided biopsy and the bronchoscopy are invasive procedures that have complications and pain associated with them. So the concept of being able to analyze somebody's breath to help determine whether a given pulmonary nodule is cancer or not could be very appealing.
Busrama says the breath test, which can be done in a doctor's office, has the potential to quickly put a patient's mind at ease in determining that a growth is benign. The test is designed to measure levels of 4 specific substances called carbonyl compounds, which are found in the breath of people with malignant tumors. The majority of patients in the study with benign nodules had at most 1 elevated carbonyl compound compared to people with stage 4 lung cancer. They had 3 or 4 elevated cancer markers. Busrama envisions using the breath analysis to confirm an initial diagnosis of lung cancer using high-tech imaging. He says the test won't be available for a number of years. Michael Busrama described the breath analysis test at a meeting of the American Association for Thoracic Surgery in Toronto, Canada. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
If you'd like to see video of Jessica's story, log on to our webpage, www.voanews.com.
And if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to VOA Asia at voanews.com.
And be sure to log on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia, where you can post your comments directly.
And we are on Twitter. Our address there is at now VOA Show. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control says that more than one-third of U.S. adults are obese.
Obesity-related conditions include heart disease, stroke, type 2 diabetes, and certain types of cancer.
And America's obesity problem is expensive. The CDC estimates that more than $147 billion was spent on obesity-related treatments.
But why are Americans so fat? And why do we keep eating things that are not good for us? Well, a new documentary from journalist Katie Couric and producer Laurie David looks at that question.
The documentary says Americans are not being told the truth about obesity and its related health problems.
The epidemic here is worse than previously estimated, much worse.
The message that's been pushed on us, it's your fault you're fat.
Shouldn't be so hard to get them to run around and play, right?
They have voracious appetites and they don't exercise enough.
It's about how active our kids are.
Forget about it. There are 600,000 food items in America. 80% of them have added sugar.
Your brain lights up with sugar just like it does with cocaine or heroin. You're going to become an addict.
You end up with one of the great public health epidemics of our time.
Couric says that she wanted to find out why, with all the reporting about obesity and illness, overeating continues to be a problem.
And since I'm trained to ask why about many things, I thought, why is this happening? We're doing such sort of superficial coverage, and we're not really digging deep to find out the root causes. So as a result, I thought, wouldn't it be wonderful if somebody really took a comprehensive look at the problem? So because we can't solve it until we understand why it's happening.
Executive producer Laurie David says that what they found was shocking, that American children are getting fatter and sicker as time goes on.
There's a very stunning stat that came out not long ago, and it was that this is the first generation of kids that are going to lead a shorter lifespan than their parents. And that is absolutely outrageous and unacceptable. And we really wanted to go after some answers, and I think we found some answers in FedUp. I think it's going to surprise people.
I am 12 years old, and my doctors have said that I am a statistic.
We're blaming willpower, and it's a crime.
Over 95% of all Americans will be overweight or obese in two decades.
We're toast as a country.
Couric says that the film, entitled Fed Up, reveals that the government is not doing enough to stop the obesity epidemic because of what she called an unhealthy alliance between the U.S. government and sugar producers.
I think every time the government tries to take action, the food industry sweeps in and with the almighty dollar gets them to change their minds. And I think as a result, we have an incredibly unhealthy marketplace. And even worse, I think people have been misled in terms of what is healthy and what isn't.
Laurie David says that even fat-free foods don't help because manufacturers replace fat with sugar to make products taste good and to make consumers buy them. FedUp opens nationwide May 9th.
Now, I want to ask you, Aisha, as a mother with a five-year-old son, let's say you take your son into the grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is he, like, instantly at the cupcakes and the chips? And
candies.
Really?
Candies, yeah. He's so much tempted
and
attracted towards those
aisles. Chocolate or, like, hard candy or?
All the different kinds of candies. And the problem with the grocery stores is, David, that they do not have them in small packaging.
Oh,
they
yeah.
have the candies in big bags.
It's like the big monster bag. But I want to know your opinion. You're a mom. So
yeah.
what can you do? What do you try to do to keep your son from getting basically high on candy?
I try to keep him away from the candies as much as I can. As I told you, I do not easily give in. And, I simply tell him no.
Mm.
You have to learn to say no.
Okay, well, what do you think? Do you have kids that you're trying to keep out of the candy aisle like my co-host? Let me know. Let us know. Send an email to voaasia@voanews.com. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Now.
If you would have any questions about something you heard on our show, send an email to voaasia@voanews.com.
Or you can log on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia. We'll read your comments and could even read them on the air on a future show.
And if you would like to send us a tweet, address it to @NowVOAShow.
Patrice Martin produces our program.
The managing editor of VOA English is Diane Gao. Until next time, I'm Aisha Khalid.
And I'm David Byrd. Thanks for listening.